Okay, let's turn to copyright infringement. An infringement is an unauthorized use of someone else's intellectual property in such a way that it infringes on their ability to exercise one of the exclusive rights that we talked about in the first section. Okay? So, for example, if you steal someone's poem or their book idea, you know, their book chapter or whatever, publish it as your own, you've infringed one of their exclusive rights. All right? If there's an accusation of infringement, the courts will turn to a three-part test. The plaintiff has the burden of proof. Again, the plaintiff has the burden of proof, and the plaintiff must show the following three things. First of all, that the plaintiff has a valid copyright. Second, that the defendant had access to the copyrighted work. And third, the defendant's work is substantially similar to the plaintiff's. Okay? So let's give you an example. Let's say that I write a poem, and I copyright my poem, and I'm listening to the radio one day, and we'll pick on Britney Spears. Britney Spears has recorded my poem without my permission. And when I contact her agent says, well, she wrote the poem. Okay? So I would be the plaintiff because I would be suing Britney Spears, right? And I would have the burden of proof. I would have to prove that I had a valid copyright, and if I had registered it with the copyright.gov folks, I would be able to show paperwork that showed that. Second, I would have to show that Britney had somehow access to my copyrighted work. Now, it is possible for two people to come up with something very similar, not having known each other or not having accessed it. It's a little bit difficult to demonstrate in the age of the internet. So if I had posted it online, you know, maybe she could have been surfing one day and read my poem, etc. But it is the burden of proof here to demonstrate that the plaintiff must show that the defendant somehow could access the copyrighted work. And finally, the idea of substantial similarity. Okay? So those are the three elements. A real life case that happened is George Harrison's case, Bright Tunes Music Corp versus Harrisong's Music. George Harrison has a song called My Sweet Lord. My Sweet Lord, da da da. And the Chiffons have a 1950s top 10 hit called He's So Fine. Do lay, do lay, do lay. All right, I'm not going to sing them for you. And I tried recording them through this system as a test, and it just doesn't really work out very well. But they have very similar note progressions. And in fact, if you go online and search My Sweet Lord and He's So Fine, you'll actually see music theorists going through the chord progressions and talking about how these songs are similar. Harrison said, well, you know, I wrote this song, but, you know, I didn't intend to plagiarize or to copy from the Chiffons. And the district court basically said, well, that's too bad. You know, it's his subconscious already knew it had already worked in a song his conscious did not remember. That is, under the law, infringement of copyright, and is no less so even though subconsciously accomplished. So in other words, even though Harrison clearly didn't intend to infringe the Chiffons' copyright, actually Bright Tunes Music, all right, he did so unintentionally and subconsciously. So it's a little bit tricky. It's a little bit tough to know where you get your ideas from. So it's a little bit of a warning to those people who are songwriters. Interestingly enough, when Bright Tunes went out of business, Harrison ended up buying up their catalog, and he now owned, when he died, the rights to He's So Fine as well as My Sweet Lord. So go figure. There's a whole list, if you want to go to that link, a whole list of other songs that have given rise to infringement cases. Go ahead and check that out if you'd like. And one of the more current ones in the news has been settled now, Joe Satriani versus Coldplay. And again, it's really hard for me to run YouTube videos through this, but if you go to YouTube and search Satriani and Coldplay together, you can listen to the song, Satriani is If I Could Fly, and Coldplay is Viva La Vida, and you tell me whether or not you think that's an infringement or not. I think it's pretty darn close. But there was a settlement, and it's sealed, and we don't know what they agreed to. So in any event, would not hurt you at all to know the infringement test for the exam, hint, hint. Okay, let's talk about a few definitions. A compilation, as I talked about last time, is a group of works gathered together. You probably have had an English class where you had to buy the Norton Anthology of Great Literature or Great Short Stories or Great Poems. That's an anthology. The compilation is copyrighted as its own work, but each individual piece has its own copyright that is licensed to the compiler. Encyclopedia is the same kind of thing. I've written entries for media encyclopedias where I talk about different areas of the law, and I own some copyright in my work, but the copyright holder for the compilation also has a set of rights. A derivation is a work that derives from another work. So, for example, Margaret Mitchell wrote Gone with the Wind, which was turned into a movie. All right, same thing with Harry Potter. Same thing with Wicked. That's one of my favorite examples these days. Wicked started out as a book, then it became a musical. I'm betting now it's going to become a movie. That's all derivative works from the original book. Okay, and so there are different sets of rights that accrue for each derivation and different clearances. Exclusivity means just what it means in real life, a monopoly. Exclusive rights are rights that accrue or affix solely to the copyright owner. So if I write Janelle's Great Opera, I own the exclusive rights to do with that opera whatever I see fit. Okay? So exclusivity is something that was created in 1976, or really beefed up in 1976, and is still the case today. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about Creative Commons. Creative Commons was created about 20 years ago by a Stanford Law professor named Lawrence Lessig. The idea behind Creative Commons was to release creative owners of the straitjacket of traditional copyright by allowing them other ways to license their work in ways that would permit other people to use their works. The actual definition is an attempt to define a spectrum of permissions for uses of copyrighted works between all rights reserved and no rights reserved. So in other words, if you traditionally copyright something, generally speaking, it's an all or nothing deal. If you copyright it, you get all the rights. You can license those rights, but you have to do that on a case-by-case basis. No rights reserved is putting it into the public domain and anybody can do anything they want to. All right? The idea here was to provide flexibility. Reasonable, flexible copyright in the face of increasingly difficult, restrictive default rules. Okay? So Creative Commons was created essentially to provide options to traditional copyright rules. If you are using one of the newer textbooks, 2010 or 2011, you'll see that a lot of those images in it were chosen by me from individuals who had licensed them on Flickr under Creative Commons. So they gave me the right, as long as I attributed the work to them, to be able to use their works. Okay, so you'll see something like licensed under Creative Commons Attribution License from Flickr. And that is a license to me, to anybody, to be able to use the work as long as they attribute it. Okay, the website is creativecommons.org. Let me show you a couple of the conditions. Attribution is the one that I have used primarily for this textbook. Okay, I am able to use that copyrighted work only if I give credit the way that the creator requests. So for example, there's a book in there, or in a couple of the editions, that has pictures of Bratz dolls. There's a case that we're not talking about where Mattel is suing the creator of Bratz dolls, MGA, for basically infringement. Because the guy who created the Bratz dolls was working at Mattel in Barbie when he created those dolls, and there's been a back and forth on that. That's not important. But what the person did was take a picture of her Bratz dolls and put it up on Flickr with a Creative Commons license. So I was able to use that as long as I gave her appropriate credit. Non-commercial basically says if you can use the work as long as it's for non-commercial purposes. Now, I didn't use any of those in my book because, you know, even though I don't make very much money, it's about a dime a book, there is the idea here that there is some money changing hands. So if you wanted to mix something or mash it up, you could use a non-commercial use as long as you weren't going to make money for it. No derivative works. Anybody can use a work if they use it as it is and not create any derivative works like mashups or mix-ups with it. And share alike. So for example, I didn't use any share alike ones because I would have had to have made my book available under a Creative Commons license and my publisher wasn't going to go for that. There are a whole bunch of different combinations of these rights, etc. If you're interested in this, creativecommons.org has a whole lot of information. Essentially, it's another way to think about copyright law. It's extra legal. In other words, there isn't really any legal foundation to it, like copyright, trademark, patent. Okay. Let's talk about works for hire. That gentleman there can work for me anytime he'd like. He's an independent contractor. Generally speaking, you own your own work. All right. If I create or write a book, I own the work unless I license the rights elsewhere. But if you contract with someone to produce work, they might own it. Okay? And if there's a contract for a work for hire, it's 95 years from the publication date. Okay? Let me give you an example. Let's say that I decide to go and work for a bank. And I am hired as the public relations professional for a bank. And I write a brochure that talks about their online banking capacity, all the services they provide with online banking. And it's really a good brochure. It describes it very clearly. And then I expand it a little bit. It becomes a pamphlet. And eventually, I decide maybe I want to publish this in a book that talks about all the different services of online banking. Now, the question becomes, who owns the original work that I created for the bank? And that's when independent contractor language comes in. An independent contractor owns his or her own work unless there's a contract. Okay? If you sign a written contract, then whatever you've signed supersedes. But if there is no contract, the work for hire doctrine kicks in. Okay? The work for hire doctrine is an 11-part test. And oh my God, you're thinking 11 parts? Oh my God. I'm never going to ask you to understand them. Really what's key about them is it measures the level of independence of a worker. Okay? The test comes out of a case called Community for Creative Nonviolence versus Reed. James Earl Reed was a sculptor. He created that picture of that sculpture down there, Still No Room at the End, and he created it for CCNV, the Community for Creative Nonviolence. There was no contract. He wanted to make postcards and t-shirts and other things, Reed did, with his work. So they owned the sculpture, but he owned the copyright in it, or so he argued. CCNV said, no, we do. We want to sell the t-shirts and posters and postcards. So it goes to court. And the Copyright Act basically says, if a person creates a work within the scope of his or her employment, the copyright belongs to the employer. But if there's no real understanding, if it's a freelance contract, then the work for hire test kicks in. Okay? The court in this case awarded Reed the copyright, which isn't that important because, again, sadly, we don't really care about what happens to the people in the law. We care about the law. All right? So he was not on the regular payroll. There was not another contract. The court determined that he was pretty independent, so he owned the copyright. But more importantly for us, the court provided a test. And the test looks like this. It's an 11-part test, and if you're freaking out right now, don't. I'm never going to ask you to memorize all of these to, you know, regurgitate on a test. It's really about measuring the level of independence of a worker. So let's go back to my bank example. There's no contract, you know, so there's nothing that's signed that would determine who owns the rights to my online banking pamphlet. So the court would take a look at this test. How much skill is involved? Well, you know, there's a fair amount of skill in my writing the pamphlet and editing it, so that goes in my favor. Let's say I did the work on their computers. That would go in their favor. Let's say that they paid me but didn't pay taxes. That would go in my favor. Let's say they could not force me to do anything else. That would go in my favor. Let's say they hired me an assistant and paid that person. That would go in their favor. It would be a back and forth kind of thing. So the court would look at all of these elements to determine the level of independence. So this test is all about looking at how independent a worker is. Okay? And you're never going to get, you know, 10 to 1 or 11 to 1. They're going to kind of try to do a balancing and see where, you know, the burden tends to come out. Okay? So that's the work for hire doctrine. And the idea here also, remember that if you sign a contract, that governs. So if there is a written contract, whatever you have signed is what is bound on you. If you have not, this is when the CCNV test will kick in. Okay, let's talk about some defenses. I didn't know it was copyrighted. The judge is going to say, well, it's up to you to determine whether or not something is copyrighted, but if you're actually able to convince the judge and jury that you really didn't know and there was no way for you to have known that something was copyrighted, they might mitigate or reduce your damages. Consent. You usually have to get consent to use somebody else's work. So, for example, if somebody wants to record my famous opera, they have to bring me a contract and I have to consent to what they're doing. That's the best defense of all. If you've got paperwork that says you can do it, you can pretty much do it here in the United States. In Europe, it gets a little more problematic because of moral rights, but we'll talk about that in a little bit. If it's public property, calendars, rulers, days of the week, measures, you can use it, of course. That's a defense. There's no infringement there. There's a 3-year statute of limitations from date of publication to file suit. We talked about statute of limitations back in Chapter 4. got 3 years to file a case, otherwise you're out of luck. If something's in the public domain, it's about a 1923 date, then you obviously cannot infringe a copyright that doesn't exist. And if you create something independently from someone, that loses one of the legs of the infringement table. Remember, we talked about infringement having three parts: substantial similarity, access to original, and valid copyright. Independent creation is me sitting on one desert island, you sitting on another desert island, and we happen to compose the same poem. I have a copyright in my poem, you have a copyright in your poem. Doesn't happen very often, but it's still a defense. Most importantly, however, for this chapter is the fair use test. This will be on your final exam, and it will be one of the case studies. Fair use is a four-part legislative test that attempts to balance certain rights of use of copyrighted works. For example, for quoting in teaching, for quoting in research, for using in other somewhat limited ways. There are some myths of fair use. Somebody might say to me, it's just, if I just use 10% of the whole work, or 5%, or 7%, or 12%, that's okay. Man, I wish there was a magic number, but there's not. There is no magic number for this. Some cases it's okay to use 20%, and in some cases it's not okay to use 2%. There is no magic number. Acknowledging it does not make it okay. And it doesn't matter if it's fair to you. The judge is going to take a look at the rules, not really what you think the law should be. The owner will appreciate this use. I've had students say that to me. Well, the guy's really going to like it when I do this. My friends, that is not your choice. It is up to the copyright holder to determine whether or not he or she will appreciate the use. And fair use is not a First Amendment right. It is a privilege, a legislative test that is provided to us to provide some limited protection. Let's talk about the fair use test. It is made of four parts. The nature and purpose of the use. The first thing the court is going to look at is whether or not the use is in one of the listed acceptable uses. For example, criticism, news reporting, comment, teaching, research. There are a couple of others, but those are the big ones. If I quote, like for example in a textbook, I quote from a news article about a case, I'm doing that for research purposes. So I am not infringing the copyright because I'm using it for research purposes. Secondly, the court is going to look at the nature of the work. If the work is basically a mechanical work, it doesn't get quite as much protection as if it's a creative work. And unpublished works get more protection than published works because an unpublished work still has potential. The copyright holder hasn't decided what he or she wants to do with it yet, and so there is additional protection given to those possible uses. The amount and substantiality of the use. How far to the heart of the material did the use go? In other words, if I'm reporting about a mystery, do I give away the whodunit? Did I really give away the only reason you might be interested in buying or otherwise consuming my version of the work? We'll talk about this a little more in just a minute. And finally, the effect of the use, which I think is probably the most important for the court. The court is going to take a look and say, you know, how likely is your use, the alleged infringing use, going to take away from the copyright holder's ability to make money off his or her creative work? So in other words, if you're going to take the market away for the creative work with your use, the court is unlikely to protect this as a fair use. The fancy legal way of saying all parts need to be considered together is no one part is dispositive. In other words, the court is going to have to look at all four of those parts, just like they did with the work for hire doctrine, and sort of see how it all falls out. Let me give you an example actually from the law. It's called Harper and Row versus the Nation Enterprises, and it's about Gerald Ford's book. Gerald R. Ford was the President of the United States after Nixon resigned, after he was almost going to be impeached. And the only really important thing he did in all of his presidency is pardon Nixon. That was the big deal. So he wrote his memoirs. He wrote a book for Harper and Row. And Harper and Row, in turn, went to Time magazine and sold them the pre-publication rights. In other words, they made a contract with Time saying, we'll get you a draft of this, and you can help us create buzz for this book. Somebody at Harper and Row decided that it would be cool to leak a copy of the book before it was published to The Nation. So The Nation got a copy of the book. And they read the book, their reporters read the book overnight, and they scooped Time. They wrote a story before Time had a chance to write the story. Time went to them and said, hey, we want our money back because we're not going to get the pre-publication rights on this. You've broken the contract. So Harper and Row had to give them back the money, but then Harper and Row sued the nation. The nation said, fair use, fair use. And the Supreme Court said, what are you smoking? It is not. In fact, all four parts of the fair use doctrine weigh against you, nation. So the nation loses because the purpose of the work was not criticism or commentary or teaching. It was to scoop Time. It was to be the first in the field. Not acceptable. Second, the work wasn't published yet. So the copyright holder, in this case Harper and Row and Gerald Ford, had no ability to make money just yet. Third, they used 17% of the whole book, but they used the only thing that people really were going to buy the book for, which is Ford's pardoning of Nixon, how he made that decision and all the drama going up to it. And so as a result, the marketability of the book was impaired. Time broke the contract with Harper and Row. They had to give money back, as well as, you know, the fact that you could buy a Nation magazine for a couple of bucks instead of spending 35 books for a hardcover copy of Ford's book. So in other words, all four parts the Nation lost. I actually got to talk with the guy who was the publisher of the Nation at the time this happened. And when I told him I taught his case, I taught the Harper and Row versus the Nation case, he shook his cane at me and said, Justice O'Connor got it wrong, you need to write to Justice O'Connor. Yeah, I'm not doing that, but the rule is basically that the fair use doctrine is still good law, and this is how it works. Okay? You need to work through all four parts of that. Okay? All right. Let's talk a little bit about fair use and parody. This is another time when I would play a clip, but it just doesn't come across very well in this recording. You're going to have to trust me on this. Luke Campbell is the one of the members of Two Live Crew. Two Live Crew made a parody of Roy Orbison's Pretty Woman. And if you listen to the two parts, Roy Orbison's is very kind of bubblegummy sweet, where he sings, Pretty Woman, walking down the street, Pretty Woman. Okay? Two Live Crew's is a decidedly edgier version. It's a scratch version. So you've got the DJ in there going, kawk, 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 kawk. And he's singing, Pretty Woman, walking down the street. And the argument was, by the courts, that the people who bought Roy Orbison's version are probably not going to buy Two Live Crew's version. They're just too different. Now, I have both of them on my iPod, but that's just me. Go figure. Okay? The argument was that Two Live Crew's version of Roy Orbison's song was a parody. And thus it was a fair use. And the court said, yeah, it's a fair use. Two Live Crew has transformed Roy Orbison's sort of sweet bubblegummy song into a rap version. And there is no way that the market for Orbison's version is going to be impaired by the market for Two Live Crew's version. Plus, we found out, parody is very, very protected. Parody is poking fun of material using the same material. And it is more protected than satire, which is poking fun of material using different material. So, for example, the best example I can come up with of parody is Jib Jab's What We Call the News. It is using the news to make fun of the news. And again, I'm really sad that I can't give you the link for you, but I can't. It just doesn't record very well on this recording. But there's the link to it. Go to jibjab.com and search for What We Call the News, and that is a perfect example of parody. In this case, they are using the news to make fun of the news. Satire would be something like Weird Al Yankovic's song Fat, where he uses Michael Jackson's song Bad to poke fun at Fat. So instead of being all gangster with it, like Bad is supposed to be, he's just talking about being overweight. Okay? So it would be like using trees to poke fun at politics. There is some protection for satire, but it is not as strong as parody. And the best example of parody I'm able to come up with is this What We Call the News thing. I suggest that you go and watch it. It's worth it. It's only about, 5 or 6 minutes long, and it's totally funny. Totally worth it. Okay. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on music licensing, but you should understand how it works. Compulsory licensing in music says that if I am the copyright holder of a musical work, I must grant anyone who wants to permission to make sound recordings as long as they pay royalties. Let me give you an example. I pick a lot on Britney Spears. You guys know this from earlier chapters. Let's say that I create my my famous opera, and Britney decides, Janelle, I like totally love it, and I like totally want to record it. I cannot say no to Britney. Because I have released this musical work, I must license her to make her own cover of it. All right? I am the one who's going to make money on this. The Copyright Act gives money to does not give money to recording artists unless they also own copyrights to their music and or their lyrics. So the artists make their money on their sales of their music on tapes and CDs, which is why downloading is such a hot topic, right? Because you're basically not permitting the copyright holder, the holder of the rights to the CD to make money off his or her works. But in this case, Britney comes to me and says, Janelle, I totally want to like record your song, and I must say yes to her. All right? The fees as of 2004, 2005, you don't have to know what those fees are, it doesn't matter, were about 8 cents per track up to 5 minutes. So let's say she wants to take two of my tracks and it totals about 10 minutes. She would owe me 8.5 cents per track per recording. So that can add up a little bit. Okay? I must release the license to her if she wants to cover it, and I am limited by the statute as to how much I can charge her. So even if I hate her with the red hot fury of 1,000 suns, I cannot price her out of the market. In other words, I can't charge her, you know, $1 million to record my song and only charge Bono, who I really like, you know, the statutory rate or less. I must charge the appropriate rate. Okay? And finally, another small thing about music, because students are always interested on how people make money. If I own Janelle's Famous Opera, I would contract with either ASCAP or BMI, and maybe both, and they would keep track of my airtime and give me royalties. They're sort of the middleman, the middle person to this. Money, again, only goes to the composers and the publishers, so performance rights do not necessarily get compensated through ASCAP and BMI. But I am rewarded for my creative works through a contract with them. They keep track. They sell blanket licenses for use in clubs and bars and, you know, elevators and whatever. And they pay me accordingly. Okay, they distribute the money to the copyright holders, to the performing artists if they own those rights, according to the formulas of airtime. Payola has gotten to be kind of a big deal where a recording artist will pay DJs to play their music. That kind of circumvents ASCAP and BMI, and it also circumvents some other, you know, additional payola laws that are on the books. Okay? So, by and large, recording artists get paid if they own the rights to the lyrics or the music, and the recording artists themselves, like Britney Spears, if she, you know, licenses a song, she's only getting paid for her live performances and her CD sales. Okay? So, if I want to license my work through ASCAP and BMI, I can make additional money through them selling licenses to my work to restaurants, bars, clubs, etc. Okay? Not going to spend a ton of time on that. You know, there aren't usually very many questions on the exam on that, but students are often interested on how it happens. And that, my friends, is the first part of Chapter 6.